I'm Hilda Gottlieb with Creating the Future. There's a small group of us today, and we're going to dive into some topics around what's next for Creating the Future. But as we always do, let us start by just touching base with each other and saying hello. If you all could acknowledge where you are, whose lands you are sitting on, and something that has been meaningful in your life recently. The reason that we do land acknowledgements, in addition to the fact that it is important just to acknowledge that we weren't the first ones here, that these lands that we sit on, especially in North America, were taken, were stolen. But it is also really important to acknowledge lineage, to acknowledge the knowledge and wisdom that came before us, and that we're not really acknowledging land, we're so much acknowledging the people who have lived on this land. So if y'all could just tell us where you are and a little bit of what is meaningful in your life. And I'm gonna call on people so that we don't get bogged down in the, oh, I don't know if I wanna go first, if I wanna. So Dimitri, how about you go first today?
Oh, wow, thank you. I appreciate that a lot. Dimitri Petropoulos from Tucson, Arizona, the most recent traditional lands of the Tohono O'odham. I don't know who was here before them, but I know that there was many other peoples who walked this land. I continue to be enamored with the fact that I'm a new grandfather and have this little baby that runs around and makes me happy when we have our little duo calls or FaceTime calls, and we get to watch her run around and have her be shy and you know, hide behind her dad and do all of that. So my awesome is a new life in the world. And then I will share, hopefully this will work, last time it didn't, but we'll try. I will share a picture of what she looks like. And that's her mom, and that is little baby Athena. And I may have shared this before, but if not, and this is actually behind their house. They live just about 20 minutes south of Napa in a little bedroom community. And it's one of the better pictures of her just looking at you and grinning. And probably the main difference is she's got almost a full mouth of teeth now. This was maybe like a month or two ago, so not bad. Anyways, that is my awesome and my acknowledgement and where I am.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. Jackie, how about you?
Yes, hello everyone. So I'm Jackie Bradley. I am on Anishinaabeg and Wyandotte lands in Michigan. And my awesome today is that I spent the end of last week participating in the Tending the Roots conference put on by the Rooted Global Village. And it was probably the best virtual conference I've been to. It was just an amazing, really, really amazing exercise in creating space and placeholders for really excellent conversations. And it was just fantastic. And I'm still buzzing from all of those experiences. So it was amazing.
Oh, I would love to debrief with you about A, the content, and B, what you experienced that made it so good. So you and I definitely need to talk.
Absolutely.
Wonderful, wonderful. I see that Farah and Angie have darkened their screens for a moment. Farah, can you share with us what's been meaningful in your life and where you're sitting?
Yeah, absolutely. My name is Farah Mahestri, she, her pronouns. I am on Ohlone land in California. And what has been awesome for me is that it is the Muslim month of Ramadan. And it's just an amazing opportunity every year to recenter, to really kind of take a priority, like think through priorities, what's really important. What has been really, really exciting this year is that it is the, you know, since 2020, the first time that we've really felt safe to gather in like small groups, still cautiously, but it is such a joy to see friends and family and to be able to gather together. And I am very, very excited to announce that I still do remember how to like chat with people in person and to play with other people's children. I was very concerned that those skills had atrophied, but other people's children are still absolute joy. And I still remember how to talk about Harry Potter with random 8-year-olds. So that has brought me a lot of joy in the last week.
Awesome. Absolutely wonderful. Oh, great. Mary, tell us where you are and what is meaningful in your life these days.
Oh, well, it's a little tricky to say where I am because Connecticut's kind of a small place and a whole bunch of people overlapped on where I live. But Wappinger, Quinnipiac, Tungsis, somewhere in the middle where they all overlapped is where I'm sitting right now. And the biggest thing going on at the moment is my daughter is just about ready to move to Brooklyn, and I'm really proud of her, and I'm really sad I'm going to miss her.
Wow, that's exciting. What is she going to be doing there?
Grad school at Brooklyn College. Wow. Creative writing and poetry.
Oh.
I got a poet.
This is very exciting. Very exciting. A friend of mine's son graduated with a master's in creative writing. He is a poet. And contrary to everybody saying, how are you going to make a living and all of that stuff, he is publishing his first book and going on tour with that.
Excellent.
So this is exciting for you, Mom. Very awesome.
Yeah.
Angie, welcome.
Hi, everyone. I'm Angie Eikenberry, she, her pronouns, and I am on the Omaha and Oto, Missouri land in here in Nebraska, and glad to be here with all of you. My awesomes are, I already told you about my awesome daughter going to Georgetown next year. I feel the same as you, Mary. It's like very exciting, but also going to be hard for us to have her gone. At least we get to go visit some, you know, cool place. And but that's like ongoing awesome news for us, I guess. The other awesome thing is like spring is here and the daffodils are out, and right now our front yard is just full of daffodils blooming, and
nice,
really nice. Yeah, we're heading towards spring finally.
Yay. Well, I am and for those of you who are not familiar, and if anyone is watching via the live stream, please tweet to the hashtag creating the future. I'm not sure anybody has told us that they're going to be watching today, but we never know. And for those who don't know, Dimitri, while he looks like he's someplace else, is actually sitting right there. We share a mic, we go on and off. And so I too am sitting in Tucson, Arizona, the traditional lands of the Tanat and then the Pasquayaki, and various people before them who go now by the name Hohokam, but we do not know what they called themselves. These lands have been continuously inhabited for, I believe it's 4,000 years. We honor that as much as we possibly can. My awesome is that Dimitri and I are getting ready to take a trip. We have not been on the road for almost a year. It is such a weird thing to be home this much. But we are taking a 3-week road trip through California. We're going to see all of our children and our little baby. Which is very exciting, and Dimitri's going to be in a wedding, so we get to be in a wedding on the grassy cliffs in La Jolla, which will be just beautiful, and get to see our kids and get to play and hopefully get a little tiny bit of alone time, which would be nice, but that's what's exciting for us these days. I'd like to start by just recapping a little bit about where we are, where we've been, and where the conversation is going today. I want to also acknowledge that we're missing a bunch of people. I don't know if I said that in the beginning, but I want to acknowledge that that several of the folks who generally attend these meetings were unable to be here today. And so there's a small group, but we can at least kick off the conversation and then kick it over to the blog and to subsequent conversations to just really enhance the conversation. This line of inquiry began last October. So we're over 6 months at this point. And it began talking about succession planning and asking the very first questions in catalytic thinking. We asked what succession planning makes possible and very quickly came to not just exchanging one person for another, but continuity of the benefit that people provide, that we provide to people who receive the benefit from us. Very quickly that became, okay, what is that benefit? And very quickly that became, where are we in the cycle of producing that benefit? What benefit are people receiving and where are we in that? Interestingly, when we initially set out and created Creating the Future, we said that there was going to be a 10-year mission. Not that we would sunset in 10 years, but that we would have a 10-year time block in which we wanted to see what could we accomplish. We saw that you all have heard us talk frequently about the fact that we saw that as the shot clock in basketball, where you can't just hold the ball forever and keep the ball, which so many organizations wind up doing because that's what the systems encourage us to do, is just keep going. But for us, it is, you're required to take a shot. And so we have 10 years in which to take the shot, and we're at year 5. So being at that sort of halfway point, there was a beautiful aha in saying, we need to celebrate that. And B, what's next? What is next in that? Our mission has always been to experiment and to share what we learn from those experiments. And the experiment is to apply catalytic thinking in a huge realm of situations, see what happens, and then share what we learn from that. And in that first 5 years, we have experimented a ton. We've not been very good about documenting what we've learned. We've been too busy doing the work. And how many organizations is that the case, where you're so busy doing the work that you don't take the time to document and to think about it? We have been doing the best we can to share what we've learned. But one of the things that's become clear from our past couple of conversations is that we really don't need to be doing aggressive experimenting anymore. That in every situation where we have applied catalytic thinking, whether that is in people's personal lives, whether that's in an organization, whether that's applying it to our own systems, whether that's doing demonstration projects, that it consistently brings out the best in people in those situations, creates results nobody dreamed were possible. And that's been pretty consistent. And so what we've been talking about is the next 5 years, probably about documenting and sharing what we've learned. And so that's about where we are today, is really just diving in to ask the basic question in catalytic thinking. And I'm gonna read this flat out. What do we want sharing what we've learned to make possible for the thousands of people who comprise our community, and importantly, for the people with whom they interact? So what do we want? And Jackie, in terms of your typing, that's right from the blog post on this. So you can lift that if you want. For those who don't know, Jackie is not only part of this team, but Jackie is documenting. She is our documentarian and takes the best notes I've ever seen of anybody who has taken notes for us. So thank you. Thank you. What do we want sharing what we learn to make possible for the folks who directly receive it and for the folks who interact with them? And interestingly, you all are part of that group. You receive the benefit. If we share what we learn, we're sharing it with all of us too. So maybe it might help to start personally. What could it make possible for you, for the people with whom you interact, if we are sharing what we've learned about how catalytic thinking affects outcomes, affects the process in general?
I'll start if everybody else doesn't mind. Documenting this makes possible for me being able to use these materials in classes with students that we have in our graduate programs, especially our, you know, MPA, where students are either already or will be leading different community organizations, nonprofit and public organizations. And so this gives an opportunity to help them see and understand the kind of catalytic thinking process. And also, I guess, in part for some students, convince them that it's worthwhile to give it a try, but then also give them some kind of, I guess, a bit of a roadmap for being able to try out things, or help them, give them material to convince others. We talked about before, you know, students who have like board members that they need to convince or to try some of these ideas out. So all of that would be very helpful to have these materials like in writing or other forms that can be shared with, yeah.
Gotcha. And if you were able to share that with your students, what does that make possible for them?
So it makes possible for them having some, I guess, security guide, you know, rail posts, I guess. And I think about like bowling, you know, the little railings on the, to like be able to try things out, but maybe in a way that it's, you know, they can see that it's worked in other situations. So that helps them, give them some support and guidance. And then also to be able to make the case, as I said, so it gives them that language, I guess, to use. Mm-hmm. As well.
Yeah. Thank you. What else? If we're sharing what we're learning.
I'll just say also, I mean, that ultimately, hopefully, sharing what we're learning for this group or others is going to lead to change, like significant change, right? Because if a lot of people are doing this, mm-hmm. It will lead to better outcomes in general.
Yep. Yeah. I'm channeling Vu here, talking about incrementalism, about the fact that standard approaches, especially to planning, tend to be incremental, to move beyond the incrementalism. It's so interesting. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I was just going to echo what Angie said about kind of the written pieces acting as guideposts. So I work as a consultant, and I'm thinking of how especially the movement aligned social justice groups I work with can incorporate some of this into their planning and how they're conceptualizing kind of broad campaigns, engagement with communities. And I think having some guideposts, some, you know, very busy people doing a lot of things as they engage with these questions, not just knowing to lead with questions and lead with these types of questions, but something that they can also go back to and say, like, okay, if I'm in the middle of a community meeting, you know, I'm standing in front of all of my neighbors, I'm trying to make sure that I'm leading through this process, having something to just as backup for them, and just that level of confidence that comes with it and ability to not veer into our standard practices of asking closed questions and leading questions and things like that.
Yeah, we so immediately go to reactive kinds of questions. What's wrong? How bad is it? No, really, how bad is it? Is it worse than that? How much worse could it get than that? Whose fault is it that it's this bad? Yeah. Yeah, go ahead.
We all learn from stories, and this creates, in essence, a big story mm-hmm. bank of examples. You know, I'm going to put this in a different context. I do tech work. I like it. It's my hobby, and I play with it. I can read how to do something, but boy, show me an example, and I suddenly understand it. And I think most people are like that when it comes to a set of instructions, is there whatever. I'd rather watch the YouTube video how to install that than to read the 2 pages of instructions. So I think that's another thing that this documenting does, is it creates a relatable story pool for people to incorporate these practices into their work and home and wherever they might want to use it.
Oh man, absolutely, absolutely. Our brains are wired to be visual creatures. So when you said if I can see it clearly, even in words, you can sometimes see something clearly, or it can be clear as mud. Yeah, because I've watched YouTubes that I still don't understand.
Yeah, but those are on physics.
Yeah.
Well, so if stories and visuals are the key, then are we able to document things in that way?
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. And Angie, you are not allowed to say my sabbatical is coming up and we're going to write that article.
That's true. I want to show you something. I have this. I have a spreadsheet like this many pages long with my to-do items for my research, and it's on that list. and it's clipped to like on right. I look at it all the time. Actually, one other thing that occurs to me when you were talking about, I mean, the archive is important and the written word and the visual, but also the process, right, of going through and documenting helps us learn, keep learning, and then having other people do that process. So hopefully as part of this whole thing, whomever is practicing Catholic thinking, having a part of it that's about documenting seems like it's important, because it just helps us to learn and reinforce those connections and so on.
Yeah. Yes. What else for the people who will benefit from our sharing what we learned? And in a million ways, we can share it via video, via audio, via written word. We can share it in however, it was interesting. Several years ago, I was in an in-person meeting. There was like a live human at the other end of the table. So it's definitely several years ago. And I mentioned that our mission is to experiment by applying catalytic thinking and to share what we learn. And she asked me, in what ways do you share what you learn? And my answer was, in any way that we can possibly find. And if you can find one we haven't tried, we'll do that one too. For the people who hear that, who listen to that, who receive that, what does that sharing make possible for them? What are they able to do or accomplish that they weren't able to do or accomplish before?
They're able to imagine new ways of doing things, and not just in the applying this new knowledge that they're learning, but also applying in different ways, because I can learn how to do something and do it the way my brain says it should be done. And that might be totally different than what Mary might think of and the way she might be practicing it in what she's doing. So just imagining what those different options could be.
Yep. Yep. very, very powerful. You know, one of the wonderful things that I love about catalytic thinking is that we so often go into any kind of thinking session. It could be a planning session. It could be a conversation like this. And, you know, with very good meaning, well-meaningly, someone will say, we need to really acknowledge our assumptions. And maybe sometimes they'll talk about busting our assumptions. What are our assumptions as we're going into this? And I find that dealing with that question directly is really difficult. I don't know what my assumptions are. They're assumptions. So they're not front of mind. They're just what I believe is true. And when we talk about, you know, we may have to bust some of our assumptions. Well, not mine. Mine are right. And, you know, I mean, so the language that we use and the approaches that we use, again, very well-meaning, because we do need to acknowledge our assumptions. But what I have found over and over again is we can do that by the questions we ask. And if I, you know, one of the questions we're asking right now is, what does this make possible for people? And it's like, oh, wow, I hadn't thought about it. Well, I hadn't thought about it is sort of saying that goes counter to my assumptions. When we start talking about what conditions need to be in place, well, people need to, let's say, trust each other. What will it take for people to trust each other? Well, they need to know each other. They need to be an environment. You know, we ask those questions. And suddenly people are going, oh, wow, you know, I've always been thinking about trust as something that, but I think about it differently. There's something in asking the questions in catalytic thinking. First of all, because they are aspirational, because they're not reactive, they are aspirational. They're deeply values-based in compassion and wisdom and in gratitude. Those questions actually help us without having to, quote, challenge our assumptions. They actually help us to at least elucidate our assumptions, at least make them clear. Yeah, I think there's something really powerful in that. Without it being reactive to, we need to challenge our assumptions, it is a gentle eliciting of those in a way that's not threatening.
I think the other thing for me that it would make possible is people being able to share it kind of with others as well. And so this goal of it being ubiquitous, you know, people, I think Hilde, in your blog articles, you talk about like people we don't know telling other people we don't know about this work. And I think all of this allows people to have some sense of ownership of sharing this with others, of really kind of going out there and talking about it and broadening this network.
Yeah. I like the ownership question, because especially if it is people we don't know asking questions of other people we don't know, it gets to be theirs. It gets to be theirs, yeah. Yeah, there's something really intriguing about that notion of it being ubiquitous. And in a couple of minutes, we'll start talking about that. Is there anything else that occurs to y'all that that this being ubiquitous makes possible for people? Or being more common?
It makes it easier to do if it's more common, right? It's not going against the established norm so much. And there's like a sense of, for better or worse, a sense of legitimacy to it that people sort of, I guess, assume more so.
Yes.
I guess that's tied to the having it in writing to or in some documented format also that applies, I think.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, I'm reminded of the strategic planning that that we quickly renamed community impact planning with the food bank when the woman that I was coaching kept hearing from her very, very businessy board members, this is not how you do strategic planning. And it was just delightful when we said, well, it's not strategic planning, it's community impact planning, because they had no idea what that meant and they couldn't say, no, this is not how you do community impact planning, because they didn't know. But again, Angie, I think that's spot on in terms of the legitimacy. That's not how you do it. Yeah. So let's talk about ubiquitous. You know, we talk about a lot, and we've talked in the past couple of conversations about catalytic thinking being ubiquitous, being everywhere. And we talked last time, I don't know, brain's not working. But in the past couple of meetings, we've talked about the fact that it is both the individual questions, the power of the individual questions, and the power of the framework as in toto. That it's not an either or, but it definitely a yes and. If that is more ubiquitous, what would that look like? I mean, what are we actually saying when we're talking about it being ubiquitous?
I think about it like broadly, people would be using the process in a lot of different situations. And then I also think about it maybe more deeply be used. Like I would remember to use catalytic thinking for more areas of my life. You know, like it would become more I would just do it without thinking, I guess, about it too much, which maybe runs counter to the idea of catalytic thinking. I don't know, but yeah, that's an interesting thing to think about further. Like if it becomes so ingrained that you don't really even think about doing it, that maybe is,
yeah,
I don't know if that's where you want to go.
Too, and that's, yeah, that's a really good question. Is that a good thing or if it's, I don't know if it's just instinctive to think that way, then that is another assumption. But mm-hmm. Our assumption is always a bad thing.
Assumptions just exist. Assumptions just exist. Exactly.
Just like I can't, it would be a long, like it would be a huge amount of success if we got to that point, I guess. I mean, I'm thinking about, at one point I put a sign on my back door that says, do you need to drive? Because I found myself just like grabbing my car keys and jumping in the car to go anywhere. And it was like half the time, probably at least, I didn't really need to do that. I could have walked there pretty easily or rode my bike there easily, but like, it just was so ingrained. And like, I had to knock myself out of like that thinking. And now that doesn't mean that I now automatically go on my bike or, you know, without thinking. That doesn't really happen. I still have to really think through that one. So maybe it's, you know, probably wouldn't necessarily happen that we would do kind of like thinking without thinking.
I'm curious about why that would not be a good thing. If people were asking the questions that bring out the best in each other, instinctively. I'm curious what the reticence is. Let's play with the reticence. Frequently, that kind of reticence is, quote, they wouldn't need us anymore. And that to me is, yay!
Yeah. That's not why I thought about it. I guess I thought about like, maybe I'm overvaluing like applying kind of critical thinking to all things, which maybe is why, maybe, you know, also problematic. So I guess, yeah, if like the automatic thing was to think about what will bring out the best in people. It's hard to imagine, yeah, that would lead down a problematic path.
It really has been so interesting seeing different people put catalytic thinking questions into their lives in different ways. We've seen so many people who are just living those questions in their relationships with their family. And we've seen just as many people who are living those questions in their workplace or, oh no, she's gonna ask, what does that make possible again? I hearken to Mark Friesen in Vancouver, who you cannot have a meeting with Mark without hearing that question at least three times. It just is his natural go-to in the questions, and it changes stuff. So what else might it look like if this were ubiquitous? What does that really mean?
So whenever someone says ubiquitous, I think of cell phones, because the previous job, that's what we always talked about. Cell phones have become ubiquitous. What else can we do with them? And I think about, and also because I feel like especially smartphones have gone from, oh my God, this is kind of a crazy idea when Steve Jobs introduced it in 2007, to like full on panic attacks if my cell phone isn't within my reach at all times. And to me, there are a couple of things to it. It's that broadening. So the cell phone went from being a phone to being a multi-purpose tool. And so Hilde, I think this like speaks to, I think if catalytic thinking is ubiquitous, it's not just a thing I use for work or a thing I, there is kind of, people are reaching for those resources and those tools more often for more things. And then the other piece of it is that like computers and cell phones and these pieces have only really become ubiquitous because one entity doesn't own them, right? If the only smartphones were iPhones, I don't think they would have had the reach that they do, because it wouldn't have been accessible to everyone. $1,000 phone leaves most of the world behind. And so to me, this is also, again, it's a question of access, but also global access. How does this translate, not language, but connotation, context, culture? And for me, ubiquitous really would be, and I think about it, not again, not just translation, but just in particular, how languages work and how questions are structured. Some languages use passive voice in a very different way than English does. There's that whole piece. So it's not just about taking something and translating it. It's about understanding the role that questions and language and thinking and engagement work across different cultures. And I think once we reach that point, that for me would feel ubiquitous.
Huge. You have me thinking, Farah, that it is we frequently talk about the fact that the doing, when people say they want to replicate a project, they're always trying to replicate the doing. And what we found is that you can't replicate the doing, because what happens in one situation is completely different than another situation. It's not just neighborhoods and countries, it's families, but that you can replicate the thinking. And what you're really making me think is that it is, these particular questions in these particular framings work in this particular culture, but you can replicate the intention. You can replicate the purpose, and that just requires changing the doing, the question, the specific question, the specific language, the specific whatever. But what brings out the best in people in this culture versus in this culture? Huge, huge. Farah, thank you.
kind of comment.
Farah, you reminded me, or made me, when you mentioned cell phones, what and ubiquitous, you know, there's no place you can go. And starting, and I'm thinking age now, there's no age level you can go where people aren't using cell phones. And they are so ubiquitous. You know, you go into a doctor's office and all age groups there, they're sitting there, they're not reading magazines, they're, you know, playing on their cell phones or doing whatever they're doing. So I'm thinking of children, you know, that very, very young children are literate in the world of phones and computers and so on. I'm thinking that part of what documenting does is it creates the opportunity for a framework for children to learn. And that then it just becomes ubiquitous. This is just how we do it. We grow up, we don't think about it. It's just automatic, you know, we always ask those questions. So you really made me think about, okay, what is ubiquitous, especially when we have such a clear example of something that didn't exist in the world 15 years ago. And now, you know, the entire world is using it. I mean, I know that many third world countries are leapfrogging wired connections and going and being able to jump to this generation because of the ubiquitousness of and the variety of options that exist out there around that.
I just was quickly going to add, I think it's also fascinating with cell phones and children in that digital natives. So, you know, the generations that are born with this technology, there's some like really interesting research out of Harvard and UCSF about how that's changed the way our brain forms neural connections and pathways. And to bring it back to the question of how we form assumptions, right? In a world where some of these leading with questions, is the norm, is that actually going to change the way we make assumptions and how we engage with assumptions at that subconscious, unconscious level?
Wow.
What else does ubiquitous look like? I sort of see ubiquitous as we don't even, sort of kind of like air. We don't even see it's there. It's just, this is how we do it. This is how we be. You know, I live for the day where instead of saying, wow, that's a really interesting question, people don't even question the question.
I'm also thinking about, because I think a lot of this is focused on the person doing the asking, but if we're saying the questions are to bring out the best in someone, what does that mean to be that other person where mm-hmm. other people are constantly bringing out the best in you and that you are able to then be at your best in all situations, if it's truly ubiquitous, what does that do to a person to be able to just be that?
We live in, at least in the developed world, we live with questions that are constantly, and with advertising and with messages in the news and with et cetera, that are constantly rooted in the stuff that brings out the worst in us. You really have me thinking about this, Jackie, really thinking about this. You know, everything from, I read my local newspaper and it says something about, let's make something up. City to institute reformative justice program that will cost $15 million. And it's like, do you even understand how that one sentence is so harmful? is so harmful. And you know, we hear it in the news all the time. We hear it on TV shows. We hear it in, I cringe. You all know that I have a real thing for the negative framing of language, where we say, I didn't mean to hurt you, instead of, I'm sorry I hurt you. The negative, don't forget rather than remember. And my biggest pet peeve is, why don't you? And we say it as a positive. Why don't you put it over there? Instead of, would you put it over there? And every time I hear, why don't you? I'm like, because I want it there. It's like, my brain just goes into, it locks. Those questions of, what does it feel like to be on the receiving end? If it's truly ubiquitous, then is it changing all of those reactive brain patterns that we have? Which gets to Farah talking about, and Dimitri talking about kids and how our brains form. And
I also, Jacqueline, to build on what you were saying, we spend so much of our time, or at least I'm spending so much of my time, on what does belonging mean in workplaces? What is psychological safety? These are increasingly, research shows this is what we're looking for. And that the way you ask that question, like, what does it mean if someone's always bringing out the best in me, creating that environment that's supportive? That would be truly transformative at that level as well, right? It's like, instead of going into meetings at work with your defenses up and like looking for the someone trying to like get me, is this a gotcha moment? What's the subtext to this question? And having those automatic defenses up, what does it mean if we're creating and holding space for each other in that way and really caring for each other? Especially as we know that a lot of the work that we're trying to do in like this, what's called like the DEI space, isn't landing. Because I think at some level, we aren't able to create those safe parameters and those safe environments for each other. And so much of it is about trying to create it for yourself, but that's just not how communities work either. We need to be holding that space for each other. That just really, really resonated with me.
Yeah, huge.
Just the amount of time that's wasted in these interactions, defending yourself or building defenses for something that may or may not happen, as opposed to whatever the work is that is part of what you're working on, what you're doing.
It is time wasted, but it's also talent wasted. Oh. Because I'm out of here. I'm tired of always being attacked. I'm always, and interestingly, the people who tend to be the most visionary and thinking about other people and more compassionate tend to be the ones that that feel that the most. There she goes again. There he goes again.
I will add, darling, last thing is that I feel like if it becomes ubiquitous, that's the other thing people save, is that instead of using their time and energy to explain what catalytic thinking is and defend what catalytic thinking is, you can use that time and energy to just apply it. And that's the other piece of ideas becoming ubiquitous, is that we're no longer having to justify they're accepted into the public space as a way to move forward. And there's kind of a common base understanding that you can build on.
Yeah, absolutely.
I gotta leave, there's that call I had to do, I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm so glad you were here, Mary. Join us again next time. So if that's what ubiquitous looks like, if it is broadly and deeply applied in a ton of situations, from birth to aged, in workplaces, in personal lives, if it is just the way we be with each other, if it is a way of being rather than a specific question that we're asking, which sort of gets to the translation of that into various cultures. If it is just the norm that we expect to both ask and receive questions in that way, what would need to be in place? What would people need to have? What would they need to know for it to be ubiquitous? And I'll kickstart by saying they would need to know that there's an alternative. I mean, even if you just in the beginning, you know, it's going to be different, hopefully 10 years down the line, but in the beginning, know that. So Dimitri and I, in the olden days, because we've traveled a lot together for a very long time, in the olden days when they were first putting GPSs into rental cars, we're traveling and we're in a rental car and we've got a GPS and we're like, oh, good, there's a GPS. We get into, I don't remember, a parking lot or something somewhere. And the GPS, we must have made a wrong turn because the GPS says there is a better way and then never tells us what it is. It's been like 20 years and we still just remember every once in a while when we're driving, one of us will say, there is a better way. But I think knowing there is a better way is important, is having the GPS that not only tells you, but tells you what it is. I think that one of the things, one of the first things that people need to have and know is that there is a more effective way of communicating with each other. Mm-hmm. What else? What do people need to know or have in order to begin to make this ubiquitous?
Well, related to my earlier point about having the sign that asks, you know, do you need to drive? Like having kind of reminders about it and opportunities mm-hmm. to practice. Like knowing that, yeah, no, and I guess some level of, you know, like support or accountability or however you want to talk about it around you in that process.
Talk more about that.
Well, until it's ubiquitous, I guess, you know, having, having an opportunity to, have people around you to help, you know, kind of help, I guess, help you in that journey. Knowing that you're not the only one, I guess, trying it.
You know,
having those examples.
When you said having those reminders, I thought of when you first have a baby, you realize how filthy your mouth is, not like for kissing, but the words that come out of it. And the first thing I know every new parent has done is have a swear jar, and you put a quarter in the swear jar every time you swear. We saved a lot of money up in that first year before Lizzie could talk. There was a lot going on in the swear jar. But it's occurring to me that having that kind of reminder, the swear jar sort of reminder of, ooh, did I just say, why don't you again? Or did I just ask, you know, whatever you realize your go-to is, that might be a...
Yeah, and there are all sorts of psychological tricks around that. And like, I mean, the whole Noom thing is all, any of you tried Noom? I mean, it's all situated around these different, what we know about how people's brains and psychology works to put in place little mechanisms, right? To in a way almost trick you to changing your behavior. Yeah, maybe we need a Noom for catalytic thinking.
I like it. What else needs to be in place? You know, we've talked about documenting in a variety of forms.
Trust. In my experience, the first thing communities want to know is that, is there a possibility that this will lead to harm? Right? There's kind of status quo. I'm willing to take a gamble on something that is new, but only if it's, you know, it's either going to maintain the status quo or it's going to make things better. What I don't want to do is inflict more harm on my community. And I think with things like this, it's, will these questions open up cans of worms? Mm-hmm. Is this going to create more conflict? Is it going to peel away kind of some of these social like norms around politeness, like, oh, we don't go there? And I think what people need is Angie and Dimitri both touched on this, is the sense of not alone. There are stories that we have tried it, that there is a sense that this does have overall a net positive. And I think being honest about some of the places where maybe it hasn't worked as well, right? And that again, it's, I think, and again, in my experience, I've seen people are willing to take a risk even if they know it'll fail and maintain the status quo. And it's okay, like I tried it, but as long as things don't get worse. And so being honest about places also where maybe it didn't quite achieve, you know, nirvana or like paradise, but no, it didn't lead to, you know, companies completely imploding. Mm-hmm. And giving people that opportunity to then make informed decisions. Like, does this feel like a risk? If so, what am I evaluating?
Yeah. I love that assumption that really the worst that can happen is you'll be right where you are. You won't be worse, but the worst that could happen is you'll be right where you are. Yeah. I think one of the things that needs to be in place just at a very, very basic level, I mentioned, knowing that there is a more effective way. I think that one of the things at a very, very basic level is stuff I can read. Stuff like, you know, Dimitri, you were talking about watching YouTube videos. I think there needs to be libraries of stuff, and not just a library, but libraries of stuff that people can access wherever. And written in the language of what somebody would type into Google when they're having a problem. You know, what do I do about fill in the blank? But I don't know what to call it except for stuff, resources. And easily available.
Yeah, accessible to anyone. Mm-hmm. So not behind a paywall.
Yeah. It's been really interesting since we turned all of our, I think just about everything we're doing now all of our click and play classes, all of our workshops, all of our webinars, all of our cohorts are pay what you can. If it's a dollar, it's a dollar. If it's $100, it's $100. And it's been really interesting. For the exact same class, we've had people pay $10 and $300. And there's something really powerful in that. And to make as much as we can free. And to me, there's also a big piece there about walking the talk of the world we want to see. You know, if we want the things that people need to be really, really accessible to them, then what does that look like if we walk that talk? What else? What do people need to have? What do they need to know?
I think people need to have teachers and mentors and wise folks they can go to ask questions. The idea of trust came up. And I'm looking at it, this is in that context. Who do you trust? And who sets examples?
Mm-hmm. Yep. You know, a thought that's occurring to me as I'm looking at this list. A lot of, and it really struck me, Angie, as you're talking about no paywall and accessibility. A lot of this is stuff that can just be online. That doesn't need to be maybe what I'm also thinking, what needs to be in place is ambassadors. You know, you mentioned teachers and mentors, Dimitri, but sometimes it's just one-on-one conversations, ambassadors. But you know, we started creating the future from teaching immersion courses. And that was just because it's what we did. There was no strategy behind it at all. And it was literally Dimitri and me still as consultants, teaching our consulting friends and colleagues because they wanted to know, how are you doing what you're doing? So completely, you know, there was no, oh, let's create something. And what would the program look like? Let's make it 5 days of immersion live and in person. None of that was in place. But what has become clear since then is that way more people, it is way more accessible. First of all, how many people can afford to take a lot of time and a lot of money and put it into their learning? If that's necessary, maybe you figure out what that means and who teaches it and who creates spaces for practice and et cetera. But I'm just looking at what we've been talking about. And so much of that can just exist online if there are ambassadors encouraging people to come to it.
I have to go in a little bit, but the Noom thing that makes me... Now that I thought about Noom, like a lot of that is right. It's an app where people are learning different things at a little chunks at a time that add up to bigger things. And there are activities there, right? You're learning stuff and then applying it. And there's also a coach for you that you can connect with as part of that process. And there's also a group. You become part of a group. that you can also connect with that group. So anyway, that Noom model might be something to think about further. Yeah.
Maybe that'll be a Creating the Future project. We'll all sign up for Noom.
Yeah, you should try it. Yeah, try it out. You can actually try it. And they also let you try it out for like 2 weeks with any amount you want. So you could say, I'm only going to pay $1 or $5 or whatever. And then if you want to join for longer term, there is a set fee. But anyway, yeah, it might be worthwhile for you to try out if you haven't already.
Any reflections before you go?
Anything else? No, nothing more to add besides like this occurrence about Noom. So it was a good conversation. I'm sorry that I have to leave early. We have a job candidate that I have to be part of that interview now.
You go do it.
Okay.
You go do it. Thank
you. See you later.
Thank
Bye.
You.
Bye-bye.
It's just us chickens here. I'm feeling like we actually have gotten someplace here. Mm-hmm. Starting to look at, and I love how catalytic thinking backs us out into, the answer is becoming more and more clear. That at least as a start, what's next clearly needs to include documentation. That y'all have made very, very clear. I'm writing the book, I promise I am. Ambassadors in some form. Multicultural sensitivity and intention. A huge store of resources, and I mean store as in storage, not buy something store. Library, rather. For a tiny little group, I think we made some progress today. And certainly something that we can post to folks and encourage them to come to the blog and continue with the next conversation. Anything else that's occurring to you all? I think probably with it just being the four of us, we should probably disband for now and wait until we've got a bigger group. But is there anything else that's occurring to you about the conversation before we step into a moment of reflection? What do people need in order for this to be ubiquitous, or even to begin to make it ubiquitous?
I'm thinking that about the continuum, and mm-hmm. different people need different things.
Yeah.
And depending on how ready they are to accept this. So I think it's important that to be ubiquitous, it needs to be presented, made available, whatever, mentors, forums, all the different ways of getting this information so that it appeals and resonates with the broadest possible. It's not a one size fits all in terms of how to make it ubiquitous.
Yeah. And I really think that there is something about we don't have to do everything all at once. I think there's a piece about it doesn't need to be absolutely everywhere and everything all at the same time. For it to begin to be ubiquitous. People need to have access to it, but they don't need to also have access to a 6-month immersion course online. And that has to do with the continuum of potential, Dimitri, of mm-hmm. People need to be able to put a toe in. And when they're ready, there's something they can dive into, but that doesn't need to all happen at once. There's something there in terms of, I don't know, maybe I'm getting ahead of myself. But things, I think people need things they can try. I guess that's where I'm going. That they need a thing they can try that is, as Farah noted before, that is safe, that feels safe to them. If they want to push themselves, there's a next thing they can try. But I think that it's really important that people need to have a small bite-sized thing that they can put a toe in. So are we ready to do a moment of reflection? Take a look at your notes, take a deep breath. For a small group, I think we accomplished a ton today. And so if you'll take a look at your notes, circle anything that's standing out to you, and let's just take a moment to share what is standing out.
Go first. I think the thing that's standing out most for me is this question that Jacqueline, you raised about what does it feel like if someone else is always kind of setting me up to be my best self, to have kind of that successful frame, and that question itself has just really opened up a lot of, you know, thoughts and really positive emotions. So that is the thing that I've like highlighted and circled in my notes.
Jackie, what about you?
Yeah, and actually the thing that I was highlighting was what Farah had said in response to that, in terms of what that would could possibly mean for the way our brains are actually working. And so if we were able to always be our best selves, what would that actually mean for our brains and the way our neural pathways are connected, and in our bodies, how does that feel and how does that impact our being and our health and all of those other things?
Awesome. Oh, yeah. How about you, Dimitri?
Yeah. I'm really pondering both Jackie's and Farah's comments around how we have within us all these self-limiting voices. And those self-limiting voices are fueled by people that put you on the defensive. And so those voices reflect that. So, you know, you're not smart, you're too old, you're too young, you're too fat, you're too short. And so that's the voice that's going on in my head. I'm never at my best. I'm always at the mercy of those voices. And I'm just thinking, wow, what if those weren't there? You know, what if the only voices were there was, yes, I can accomplish this. Yes, this is possible. And what would that mean for me? What would that mean for everyone around me? What would that mean in the world? So I'm sort of reflecting on that question. What if everybody in every situation was working to bring out the best in me? And that's what I walk into every situation. That's what I walk into. Therefore, I'm not wasting time, energy, emotional energy on defending myself, feeling inferior, feeling superior, whatever the things are. So I'm kind of reflecting on, wow, that's a really powerful way of looking at this from both of those perspectives.
Amazing. And really what's standing out to me as I'm really looking at everything that we talked about in what needs to be in place, and I mentioned this before, is it doesn't feel overwhelming. And I know that's framing it in the negative, but it has for the past several months felt overwhelming. There's so much to pull together, and if we are to, there's a lot of different ways to scale the mission. I hate the word scale, but to scale the mission, to create more ripples of the mission. And a lot of the ways that we've been talking about are really intensive. And so that's been making me nervous. And these all feel doable. Documenting and sharing and having ambassadors and having folks who can participate to make sure that in this culture it is different than in this culture, and it fits, and does it fit? And to even ask the question, does this make sense in this culture? And if it does, you know, what would it take? It just feels very doable. And that right there is, I can just feel my shoulders sort of relaxing a little bit. So I'm very grateful for the conversation. And I'm also really excited to get more comments on the conversation, to get folks talking, and to get us together next time and to keep exploring and see where this takes us. Because as we define what's next, we'll actually do that. So thank you all. I really, really appreciate it. And Jackie, could you just stick around for one sec? Thank you, Farah. We'll see you soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hey, everyone.
I stopped recording. Did you stop recording?